Welcome to the Lazy CEO Podcast. I'm Jane Liu. Join my conversations with the entrepreneurs behind the iconic brands we all know and love.
Hey, Potty fam. Welcome back to part two of our chat with Airtasker's co-founder, Tim Fong. Super quick TLDR in case you missed it. Airtasker is Australia's largest marketplace for local services. In this part, we hear more about the hustles Tim had to push through to get the business going, how he achieved profitability, and his leadership and management style. I in particular love his mantra of being okay with being uncomfortable. All right, let's get into it. Let's go back a bit more to the beginning. Like, what were the really hustle startup stories that you've got?
So early on, we did a lot of the jobs ourselves. Jono and I would be like, oh, that one, I reckon needs to happen.
You just want job completion, right?
Right. Yeah. So we were just like, you know, and it was also like, you know, demonstrate to the team that do whatever it takes sort of get done. So I remember doing a KFC delivery late at night.
Oh, maybe it's my friend's KFC delivery.
Well, I ended up going to three KFCs around Sydney because it was late at night. I finally did deliver the KFC, and then I found out the person was like friends with one of our investors. So I was was that all worth it? That was one example. I think another was we were kind of working out, hey, we need more jobs on this platform. It's really hard to get people to post jobs because you've got to change their behavior. What if we went to people and we sort of said, hey, we'll do this big project for you and we'll break it up into little jobs for you. But, you know, we'll do this big project for you. And one of the things that we zeroed in on was we could go to real estate agents and say, hey, if you want us to do those letterbox drops for you, we'll go and do that.
Right.
And so for about 3 months, I was coordinating letterbox drops for real estate agents.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, that is really hard work. That was painfully hard. It sounds easy, but when you actually delegate these jobs and, you know, sometimes the flyers go missing or sometimes you'd find the flyers, you know, in the bin or something like that.
People shove three in the letterbox.
Exactly. And so I viscerally remember, you know, real estate agents calling me and going like, hey, I'm in Newtown and the flyers I gave you are in the bin. What are you going to do about it? And I'm like, oh my God, on the weekend, I have to like drive, pick flyers out of a bin and sort them all out. And that was a great learning for us. And it's hard to tell in a network effect business whether maybe that was critical, you know, to have gotten those 100 extra jobs might have been part of what was required. I don't think it was.
you don't know. Waldy was like, I remember you being at Ryan's bar and you meet someone and you grab their phone and you make them like Shopo on Facebook. Yeah. And he's like, but that was great. You just hustle.
Yeah, yeah. Manual.
Manual. Yeah, very manual. And what were the biggest mistakes you've had, the biggest fuck ups and then the lessons?
Look, I think the biggest screw up was probably being around like some of the people type stuff, which is really hard, right? I think one of the things we could have invested into earlier would have been recruitment, you know, spending more time on recruitment. Basically.
Getting the right people.
Right people. Knowing what you want would be, it's a hard thing to do. You know, people talk about culture and principles and, you know, how you hire the right people. It's freaking hard.
Well, it's posting a job, like a big job, a long-term job. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. but then also anticipating like what you need. And I think that is probably something that just comes with experience over time. But certainly as a 28-year-old, you're like, oh, we need to hire some developers. Cool. Do you know how to develop stuff? Great. Yeah. You got the job. I remember one of our, you know, interview questions like, oh, what do you like doing on the weekend? And I'm like, what would I have done with that information? Like, this is not critical to knowing whether someone's going to be the right person for the job. So I think that's something that I would have done very, very differently if I had my time again.
What's your leadership style like? And how has that evolved?
It's definitely evolved and it's kind of gone through some evolutions. I think there was definitely a period of time, you know, we talked about hiring senior people. That's a really hard thing to do in a business, I think, you know, bringing in an executive team and letting them do their thing. We've been through various stages, but I think that prior to the last few years, we probably let go of the reins too early. You know, we sort of let people come into the business and say, here's what I think we should do, as opposed to knowing what needs to be done, hiring people and then managing them to actually get that outcome.
I completely agree with this.
Yeah, so that's something that's changed a lot, I think. And it's been forced on us a little bit because we've had to make the organization more lean and that during this economic crisis where you can't raise money. And so, you know, you're forced to like, you know, make sure that every single person here is adding a lot of value. In doing that, you get more hands-on. You have to know what you want a lot more. I think one of the big things that people do too much of in management these days is they think management is more about supporting people than it is about directing and guiding people. Management does have a big part of supporting people, for sure. You know, people have problems, you want to go and help them with them. But it's also a lot to do with, you need to know how to get to the end. And then you, if you see someone that's going off track, you need to be able to bring them back in and say, don't do it that way, do it this way, because we need to get to the end. I think because maybe during the Industrial Revolution or whatever, it was too much of that. The common wisdom now is, oh no, do less of that, do more supporting. But I think now the whole thing is all about supporting, and everyone's forgot, hold on, your main job as a manager is to get an outcome and tell someone how to get the outcome.
He thinks I keep making, and he's right, it's not a democracy. It's your business. You need to just set the direction. You can get asked for advice, but you don't have to like get everyone's approval. Like, cause I think I try too hard to bring everyone on the journey, which is important. But when you overdo it, you're not actually like.
Yeah. And often you just annoy people by basically being indecisive and stuff like that. And so I think you wear a little bit of pain when you make a decision and not everyone likes it. But I think the net trade-off is probably positive. That's something that I'm trying to do a lot more now. And the reason why I think it's hard is because you've got to put your neck out there and say, this is what I think we should do. And a lot of people you find don't really want to do that. And so I think that's where a lot of, you know, this sort of supportive management culture comes from, because it's not just supporting people. It's actually just sort of passing the buck down. You know, like the CEO says, what do you think? The director level person goes, well, what do you think, to the manager? Yeah. The manager goes to the IC and goes, well, what do you think? And then there's no thinking happened. Yeah. And so I think that needs to change a little bit. And I've tried to, you know, have the courage to go after that a bit more.
By the time it kind of passes down the chain, it's like the initial objective has like, people have lost sight of what we are trying to achieve.
Right.
And then what you end up doing doesn't actually achieve what you set out to achieve.
That's right. And I think a critical thing is nipping those things in the bud. Like, if you're not happy with it, I think it's your job as the leader to go, I'm not happy with that. And maybe my brief wasn't perfect at the beginning, but I'm going to not let that happen. I've tried to not let things go so much now as well.
Did you see Airtasker as a successful business model overseas? Like, did you have that confidence, or was there a point after the business started? It would have been hard because you were doing 20 jobs a day. And then 6 months later, you said you will have days when you're doing even less, or 17 jobs a day. Like, were you worried like, oh my God, does the business model actually work? Like, was there a point where you felt it was validated?
So there's like different gates of like validation, right? Yeah. You know, there's, oh my God, this could be a complete dismal failure.
Yeah.
Through to, okay, it's not a complete dismal failure, but you know, it's still not real. And there's probably a couple of steps. But I think the main thing for me was probably getting profitable, because until you can really pay your own bills, you're always kind of going like, does this deserve to live? Like, it's only living because someone else has got it on life support right now. And so I'd say like in 2019, when we got to sort of cash flow profitability, that was probably the first time that I was like, okay, we actually built something here. That's legit.
God, that's 7 years.
No, it was ages. No, it was totally depressing. Like every year, you know, often people would say, oh yeah, that's success, you know? And you're like, oh, I don't really think it's anything yet. And probably took that long to get to any sort of feeling of comfort.
Were there big moments in society or the economy at a macro level that caused big step changes in people taking up jobs or posting jobs? Like, you know, you said like there was a shift during COVID in the type of jobs. Like, were there moments where people actually started?
Well, I think there were a couple of things. I mean, I think we were like super lucky that we had a good run from basically 2010 to 2019 from our point of view, to be able to like raise money. Every year it was not like tech just went on this mad tear, and it was not uncommon for multiples to be expanding and valuations just to be going up, and everyone's excited about it. I must say that that's mostly luck, because I think if you had started a network effect business in 2018, it'd be bloody hard to be going through the current period now. There's not economic growth. So you've got a headwind from an economic growth point of view. No one wants to invest into a business unless it's profitable right now, which is impossible in a social network or network effect type business. I do definitely thank our lucky stars that we were able to get through. You know, we just had a clear run for 8-9 years, which is lucky. I think for us as well, there was the theme of, I think they called it collaborative consumption at the beginning, but sharing economy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Which was like, you know, people are getting used to Airbnb and Uber and all these kinds of things. And that was also a pretty big tailwind for us because we were able to say, oh, well, if you trust someone to live in your house, you know, you can probably trust them to come and do jobs for you.
Yeah.
You know, they definitely helped build that tailwind and we sort of jumped on the back of that, which is great.
Yeah. No, I can definitely see that. You use the term luck, but I think it sounds like all your like stories that you've just rolled with the punches really well. Like, you know, getting made redundant. Okay, that's an opportunity. Okay, I'm just going to go work for this person for free. And then like, how lucky, now they're paying me. Like,
the optimism's definitely necessary, right? And sometimes it's rational, sometimes irrational. But I think for the most part, optimism is a good thing. The reason why I think it's hard in some of these leadership roles is you have to be optimistic. If you're optimistic, you run the risk of being the person with egg on your face when you're like, yeah, we can go do it. And then you can't do it. That's a harrowing experience for a lot of people. But I think net-net, it pays to be optimistic.
You used to think I missed out by not doing a marketing degree because I actually wanted to. But then with my cadetship, I had to do accounting and finance. I actually realized it's probably a blessing in disguise because, you know, there's traditional marketing and the fact that Shopo did social media so well, I had to like figure it out myself. But you do have a marketing degree, which is cool with a commerce degree. Like, how do you think, did that help you? And like, what were the more successful marketing like campaigns that kind of drove your growth?
Total love and respect for UNSW marketing. I don't think that was probably, you don't take a lot of that theory into practice.
No, I wouldn't think so. Yeah.
I think the things that are probably more relevant when it comes to our kind of marketing, it's probably more like behavioral psychology books, you know, like Nudge and, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow and like, how do people's brains actually work? Like, I think that's the kind of stuff that is more useful in marketing for us. I guess like some of the quirky things that that are a bit different in our marketing is that most of the businesses around when we were scaling were SaaS companies. Mm-hmm. And in SaaS companies, PR is usually not your main tool. Like the main tool is get a few people to use it, get really low churn and high retention, get pricing right, scale it with a sales team. And PR's like, I don't know, send out a press release once a year on a product release or something. For us, PR was the main driver because we needed to change people's behavior and kind of just tell people, hey, this is normal. This is happening. People use Airtasker for X, Y, Z and inspiring them. And so what we realized is that we had to figure out a way to be part of the story every single day. And so rather than just kind of trying to talk to media about what we wanted to talk about, we kind of did customer-centric PR where we'd be like, well, what do you want to write about, journalist? Do you want to write about Apple? Because, you know, Apple iPhones were a big deal. We're going to join the Apple iPhone queue and we're going to be part of that story. And then you can ask us because we'll be experts in lining up for Apple iPhones.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Or if it was, you know, like recently was the passport queue. Passports were taking a long time to get. So we had people lining up and we didn't engineer this, but we found that people were lining up for passports. We highlighted that to the journalist. Mm. The journalist can then go talk about it. So it's quite an interesting thing because people always tell you be customer centric.
Yeah.
But in PR, people aren't really customer centric. Often they're just writing a press release saying, this is what I want to say to you. Yeah. And they're like, oh, but no one's going to write about you if you're just saying what you want to say. Why don't you find out what they want to say and then talk about that?
Oh, that's brilliant. In terms of like other elements of brand marketing, because I just feel like it's such a thing that's like hard to measure. And it's a constant thing that we debate as Shopo, like how much emphasis put into brand marketing. And I know it's big for fashion, but like, how do you kind of justify, validate how much like spend and effort to put into it?
This is where I reckon it's like judgment and courage because it's one of those classic things. You're going to spend millions of dollars or something on marketing. I don't think I have a good idea on what is working, what's not working with precision. And I think a contrarian statement, I think that a lot of marketing attribution and stuff people are sort of taking advantage of the fact that you would love to know, I spend a dollar, I make back a dollar ten. But you can't ever really know that because, you know, if you just think about the fundamentals, how do you know why someone did something? Mm. It's an impossibility to ever know why they did something. You might show them three outdoor ads and then they finally click on a Facebook ad.
Yeah.
Or it could have been that they looked at three Facebook ads, but finally went and bought it, you know, in some other way. And so I think there is a little bit of like overemphasis on trackability and
attribution,
knowing. Yeah,
ROI,
you just can't know. And so in a funny way, because the internet, like everything is on the internet now, it's gone full circle. We've basically gone back to the Mad Men era where it's like, well, I guess I'm going to have to put up this awesome TikTok channel, invest a bunch of money into it, and I hope that that drives sales. But yeah. I don't really know because, you know, the click attribution and stuff like that, that worked well when 99% was offline and 1% was online. Yeah, you could tell, oh, well, if I show this online ad, that's the difference, right?
You just start one channel at a time. Yeah.
But now it's like, oh, well, everything's online. Who knows where they came from? Yeah. And so I think it's like judgment and courage to be able to make some of these calls around. We know that we have to invest a lot into brand. And so we do that. But I don't think there's a good formula to know how much.
Damn it. Yeah. I was hoping you had the answer. I don't have the answer.
No answer. The answer is feel comfortable that you might be wasting your money.
Yeah. Spend what you're willing to lose, just like in business.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. That's a good way of thinking of it.
You went public in 2021. What was the decision to go public? That's huge.
So we basically were watching what Afterpay was doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those folks kind of just nailed it in terms of timing and all those kind of things. But we saw that what they were able to do was go to a new country. We've got this product. It works in Australia. We're going to a new country. Fund us to do that, you know, with a big listed share price. Go and do it. Show some results. Do it again. And we're like, that looks awesome. Because that's what we had discovered during COVID was we have a product. It works, but we want to take it to more places. Mm-hmm. And that's going to cost us a lot of money.
Yeah.
That was really the inspiration for going public. I think we had a good run at the beginning because it turns out in retrospect, it was this massive boom time. We weren't greedy with we share price and valuations and stuff like that. We ended up listing with a multiple about 9x revenue or something like that, which was back then super conservative. Now it's probably on point or maybe, you know, considered generous, but it was absolutely cheap for that period. We had then this problem though that the share price went so high immediately that we had a lot of institutional investors be like, well, I just made the return that I thought I'd make over 5 years. I made it in a day.
Yeah.
So I've got to sell out of this.
Cash out,
I've got to cash out. Like, you know, that is the dream. I just lived the dream in a day. Because basically we listed at 65 cents and the share price went up to close to $2.
Oh my God.
In 3 days. So it was like 3x your money. And you know, I don't hold it against those fund managers. I'm like, well, that makes sense. Like, you thought you'd just make that over 5 years, you made it in a day. So we had that issue. And then the share price then sort of leveled out at a good level. It was about 50% higher than the IPO price. But since then, from 2022, beginning of 2022 to now, it's just been really, really hard because people are just not interested.
Yeah, with every other share price, I'd imagine. How do you find that now as the CEO of like a listed company? Like it's already hard enough to watch like revenue and like jobs posted. Now you've got to watch the share price and like the share price isn't even directly, it is affected by business, but it's also like people's expectations. Like it's not, it is hard
definitely,
to manage.
It's definitely intertwined into performance because it drives your cost of capital. Mm-hmm. Like if your share price is high, your cost of capital is very low. Basically, then you can make all these risky bets with money. If the share price is low, the opposite's true. Everything becomes so much more expensive to fund. Well, first of all, I would say, without wanting to like espouse like platitudes on people, I genuinely don't look at the share price very often because you can't really do too much to change in the short term. And honestly, it's not really a reflection of what's going on in the business. And I can also say that coming from a place of having a very high share price is just as harrowing as having a low one because you're just sitting there going, this can't last. You're almost telling people like, can you not do that? Yeah. Don't put the share price so high because we don't deserve that yet.
Yeah.
Like just keep it steady. So I don't look at it too much. It does obviously make it harder in terms of like people's compensation, because you want people to do really well. When the share price is going down, that's a hard thing to do. Conversely, now that it's on the way back up, it's a great thing because hopefully all of your employees and team members are just getting a little bit more every single day. But look, I think it's been fine for us. We'll put it this way. If you kind of take the opposite of being public, you know, being private, you have the other problem, which is if you ever needed to raise money, you would probably find out your valuation then. And that may be even harder. So in some sense, being public just lets you know every day, this is where you're at. And you can raise money. Like, we could raise money at any time. It's just that we would do it at a really bad valuation. Mm-hmm. I think if you're a private company, it'd be more like, well, can you even raise money? And the answer may be you cannot raise money at any valuation and you're actually, you know, that's hard. So there's pros and cons of public versus private.
So you've expanded into the US and UK. And how have you found that? Because it's an amazingly big market, but then what's the competition like? Are you like a small player? And how is it being a small player in this big?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Pun.
We have a really good business model for international expansion, which is that we have the main fixed costs in the business is building the software, and that is built. And so when you go to each new country, you don't have to reestablish all of those fixed costs. So we spend like tens of millions of dollars a year on product, engineering, design, all those things. But those are fully internationally scalable. So the only thing that you're really funding when you go into each new country is the marketing. And from our perspective, the hard bit about that is you have to do a lot of it upfront and reap the benefits later. And so we were sitting on that, and that was, you know, just grinding away at that. And then we sort of thought, you know, what we did in Australia with Channel 7, that was a good idea.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we basically got them to become an investor in us and actually want to promote us. In the UK, we went and did that deal. We did a similar deal with Channel 4.
Yeah.
And I think what we've done, which is interesting, is each time we go to a new country, we set up a new company and we go, this company gets all the software for free and it just has to pay marketing costs. And then we say to a local media investor, why don't you invest into this local business and you can really scale it with us and make a good startup return. So we valued our UK business at around $30 million. And that's exciting because it means that a local investor could turn up from a $30 million business, hopefully to a $1 billion business and get 30x. They're keen to do that. So we've replicated that in the UK. We've got a great partner with Channel 4. And in the US, we think there's a great opportunity to do that again. And the media landscape over there is, you know, even bigger. So, and probably has even more difficult problems right now in terms of monetizing content and ad space. So it's a pretty, pretty big opportunity.
That's very cool, actually, when you think about it like that.
Hey, Polly fam, I've got something special for you. For a limited time only, I have a discount code for my business course. In case you didn't know, the course is a blueprint for starting an online business and growing it to 7 or 8 figures. It's 10 modules of videos that you can watch at your own pace, covering everything from sourcing product, growing and developing your product range, operations, and marketing and scaling your business. Just use the code podcast at checkout at thelazyceo.com.
How are you balancing it all then? Because you have a 6-month-old.
Definitely the work from home Zoom culture has definitely made that more possible to do a lot more without having to travel. You got to travel a little bit. Obviously, like if you're trying to do a big investment deal with somebody, people don't write checks for $5 million, you know, without, you know, meeting you and knowing who you are generally. So I have done a little bit of traveling, but, you know, we've also traveled with the baby too. So that's been good.
That's right. Tim was saying just before we started that he just came back from Japan with a little 6-month-old and apparently you can drop the kid off. I'm like, yeah, I need to check this out.
I think that's actually probably easier than traveling with a 2-year-old.
Oh, definitely. Because they don't move. Yeah. Oh, my God. So you also acquired Oneflare. They're number 3 in the market. Who's number 2?
Hipages.
Oh. What was the decision to acquire a business?
There's a couple of things. I think first is it's a network effect business. So scale it in its own right is value. It's like a nightclub. If you've got a nightclub and there's a nightclub next door, rather than having a wall in between it, if you knock down that wall and put it all together, you've probably got a bigger party. All things being equal, you've got a better party. There's definitely an element of scaling network effects. The second thing we kind of discovered is they run more in small businesses where the taskers or the people doing the work are small businesses, whereas on Airtasker, it's more individual workers. And so people who are running small, like law firms and accounting firms, or have a larger trade practice are generally on Oneflare and they're not on Airtasker. One of the things we wanted to move into is those small businesses. There's a different product proposition there. It's more subscription-based on Oneflare. And so we're still looking at like, how do we bring these two things together and really get the value?
Hired a gardener on Oneflare. Sorry, Caitlin here did it for me. But like, it still says Oneflare powered by Airtasker. Have you like consolidated things for synergies?
Yeah, we consolidated the back office. Uh-huh. So like the finance team, ops team, customer service teams, all of those things have been brought together. We're very sort of like user and product centric company. I think it's really good to go slowly. You do not want to be like just turning things off.
And
I think the biggest thing that's one of my team members sort of highlighted to me is you don't want to be that person who thinks that the product that you invented is the best sort of by definition and therefore try to change the acquired company into your company because it lived for another reason and it has different value to different people. And so we're really going that journey now of like, there's a reason why Oneflare succeeded in parts where Airtasker didn't. What exactly is that? And how do we double down on it?
When did you acquire them?
June 22.
And then how does that conversation start with a competitor?
You know, all of the Oneflare founders, I think, went to UNSW as well.
Oh, so, I know.
Yeah, shout out to all those guys. Yeah. But Tommy Lim, Adam Dong, and Marcus Lim, they all went to UNSW and they all did different degrees and stuff.
What year?
I think they're around.
At the same time? Yeah. I feel like they sound familiar, but
they might be a bit younger than me.
Okay.
I am getting older now, so I think they are a few years younger than me.
Yeah.
But they had ended up hiring a professional CEO, Billy Tucker. I think that the catalyst really was everyone could see the writing on the wall. Funding is over. Like, no one's going to be raising more money for a business like this anyway.
Yeah.
In Australia. Like, unless you're an AI product or something right now, it's pretty hard to raise money. Yeah, that was certainly the catalyst for it. We kicked off discussions and we finally got there. But it was a pretty long, sort of dance to get to finally doing that deal.
So in Australia, you being number one, now having number 3, like, how much growth do you think there is in Australia? How much do you think you've like saturated of the addressable market? Because there's just certain people, right? Like my parents, like they'll never go on Airtasker. I will hire a job to do for them, right? So there's certain parts of the market that will just never do it. Like how much do you think you've penetrated the market?
I think in our niche of like very small tasks that are everyday tasks in metro areas where people can actually remember to use Airtasker, it's probably like, I think we've captured that space. And so we do need to work on like, how do we expand that out? There are two like really important vectors for us. I think one is Airtasker requires a high degree of salience. So basically if you had a little Airtasker angel sitting on your shoulder going, do you want to Airtask that?
Yeah.
I think you would see a crap load more inspiration for people using the product. And so we're trying to solve for how do you build in that salience into the product so that you can be there for people in more ways than just at that cruxy point where you need your task done. The main user story I get is, have you used Airtasker before? Yes. How'd it go? Oh, it's really great. It's fantastic. I haven't used it again though, in the last year or something. We're like, why not? And they go, I didn't need anything. And then we go, do you need a tax return done? They're like, yeah, I did. Like, why didn't you think of Airtasker for that? And they're like, oh yeah, I guess I never thought of Airtasker for a tax return, or like I never thought about it for X. And so I think it's like inspiring slash improving like salience is one big thing. And then the second thing for us is just reducing a lot of the friction around rebooking. So one of the things is that people use Airtasker for the first transaction and they don't use it for more transactions. And it makes sense, right? Because if you think that we charge, you know, 20% or whatever, why would you pay us 20% for an ongoing transaction? Like, mm-hmm. we don't want to make 20%. We don't think it's fair to make 20%.
Yeah.
And we don't want that for you either.
Because of the initial risks and then the effort. And then afterwards, correct. People can just like go offline and be like, call me if you need another
exactly.
job.
Yeah. There is a large amount of value still to be provided to those second transactions, but mm-hmm. people aren't going to pay 20% for that. Mm-hmm. And so we've built a new product, which is a much cheaper one. So basically, you can just keep your little list of Airtasker contacts and you can go back and forth with them and you only pay 1.9%. We think that that has huge opportunity because then you become the place to manage your fleet of taskers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, just it's a way to keep it all in one place. Make sure you've got all the documentation, that you're covered by support, insurance, mm-hmm. the payments itself is really convenient. But I think the main thing is getting it out there that we don't charge big fees on that.
Yeah.
Because that was kind of the issue with all of these marketplaces that tried to charge 20%. It doesn't make sense to charge someone 20% after they've already met.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was so much education involved in what you have to do.
Yeah, it's going to take ages.
Yes, because it's like the initial risk is so different for subsequent transactions.
Yes.
And then, but it's also like, it's nice to have that portal to keep it all together. And then also still take out, there's still some risk. So.
And people don't want to, in general, like be sharing their phone numbers around and having all of these like old crusty business cards and stuff. Like, it's much better if you have a list that just says, here's my pool guy, my tree guy or girl, you know, my cleaner, you know, and just have them on top.
And then managed by the platform as opposed to like this transaction, who knows?
It's not so much management, but it is what we call transparency and accountability, which is by having it all in one place where Airtasker's customers and community team can see it, it just means that if you make a promise to someone that says, I'm going to turn up on Thursday and I'm going to do this for you for $100 and you don't do it, well, you got to be accountable to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of the value in its own right. Whereas, you know, sometimes when you're dealing with a dodgy tradie or something, you know, someone doesn't turn up and you can't do anything about it and it's frustrating.
Yeah.
And so,
so what's next? You've got so much to do.
Well, we're actually trying to do less in some ways.
But you've got like two countries you're expanding to and now you're a listed company.
Yeah, well, we're trying
and
to
then
do
you're
it.
Trying to educate people about this like secondary rate.
Well, if it's any, you know, consolation,
optimist,
it's a lot less than what we were doing before. So we're trying to do even more things before. But yeah, really focused on really one product bet at a time. So as an organization, we all rally behind one area of the product and we really want to release and nail that. And it's not just the engineering team, it's marketers, everybody get behind that, scaling into new countries. But really what we're trying to do there is build the playbook of stuff that worked in Australia and just try to refine and do it the same way, but, you know, customized to the local country. It's not as big as a thing as maybe it sounds.
Mm.
Well, I'm trying to make it less of
It's less daunting. Okay, well, this is a good segue to shift gears. What does home life look like for you? Well, how do you balance it?
Home life is really, really good. My wife, who also works, Modi, who works at Airtasker, she's on mat leave at the moment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we really embraced doing that for a good year and make sure that our baby has a good start, you know, and get the support.
You guys have been together since UNSW days? Or you-
oh, even earlier. Yeah,
oh, really?
Even earlier. So, well, we actually met in high school. So,
yeah, right. Yeah. She also worked at Airtasker. What does she do and when does she do it?
She's a marketing exec. She's gone across SEO, paid, basically all of our growth marketing. So done lots of different things, but it's really good to, you know, have someone who's on the sort of strategy and commercial side of things and can go across a lot of different projects.
And how do you guys find, like, do you talk about work a lot?
I actually think rather than sort of switching off, I've actually found that it's better to just try to be balanced all the time. Like, don't try to be like at work, don't talk about home and, you know, everything's just, you know, full bore all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, like at home, I don't think it's useful to be like, can't talk about work.
Yeah.
But that's not something, you know, I think it's just a bit of balance all the time. And so, you know, we talk about some stuff about work at home. And in general, I've found that that's like the trade-off on that is better than not talking about it.
Like sometimes we're like three bottles of wine in and then the conversation shifts to work. I'm like, I'm just going to have to stop you. We're not talking about work right
now. Yeah, well, look, for sure. Like, there's sometimes we're just like, not now.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have rules. But
Yeah. No, exactly. So what are some of the things that you do personally in your work routine that to keep yourself motivated and focused?
I think recently it's been doing less at work, feeling less compelled to like push people all the time to do stuff and actually just giving people more space and having fun at work when you're doing that. Because I found that like it all sounds very self-serving, which is why I think that I probably haven't done this before. But in general, I found like having fun at work, less pressure on things and less kind of like not less urgency, but giving yourself more realistic time and space to do stuff well, you end up getting a lot more done. Like if you just sort of zoom out over a year, I'd say that last year when we had to let people go, you know, we had to do a round of redundancies, we had less money, less of everything, we actually got more done than we've ever done before because we said, we just sort of set the bar or the targets at a more realistic level.
Yeah.
And then we had fun while we were doing it. And that's been something that I'm really trying to actively do. Like just lighten up.
Yeah. I love that. Our values are think big, get shit done, have fun.
Yeah.
Because like ultimately, like that's what having a business, you want to enjoy it, right?
Yeah. And it's also like, I think as the business matures, you become less like this is a project which has an end date and more like this is a thing that ongoing. Needs to be consistent and ongoing. And so like you got to enjoy it. Like you're not having fun. Why bother?
This is your interview question that you're like, what am I doing with this information? What do you do to switch off? Like what do you do on your weekends? What's your guilty pleasure?
I love rock climbing. So we do lots of bouldering, which I think is a good way as well. Those kinds of things force you away from work, which I think is good. Like you can't
be on your phone.
You can't not
you
be
need
think,
your hands.
Yeah, you cannot be thinking about it when you're terrified of falling off some wall. Yeah. What else do we do? I mean, I do a bit of running and exercise and stuff, but I think I was born in the wrong country in the sense of like interest in sports are all sort of like mountain and cold related sports as opposed to, you know, beach and
surf.
We never go to the beach even though we live near the beach. Rock climbing.
We never go to the beach
either. You know, try to go skiing as often as I can and things like that.
So what is the best advice that you've received in business or life?
I'm going to counter a little bit on that. And so I think the main thing with advice is to be able to just sort of ingest it and put it into the pot together with the stuff that you know and other bits of advice and not to take it all too seriously. Mm-hmm. Because whichever blog post you most recently read, it'll have some sort of very definitive rule or like, this is what you should do. Yeah. You know, wake up early and answer your emails and clear your plate before the day starts. And then you kind of read somebody else who will be like, letting time to think about things before finally making decisions is good. And you're like, but those two things can't both be.
Yeah. I mean, right now, being January, there's so many like posts out there being like, wake up half an hour earlier.
Yeah.
And it's like,
It's like mostly rules are not good.
No.
And explicit advice is not good.
But I think also people just look, what is it, confirmation bias? Like people just like, people who are listening, they're just like looking for the things that I think people have an intuition of what they want.
Yeah.
And they're just looking for bits of like what you're saying that kind of validates it. Because sometimes I go and have like, I used to have time to have coffees with people who reach out and want to get business advice. And I'm like, they're not listening at all. They're waiting for the one thing that I say that like, they know what they want to do. They need the confidence. They just want you to go, go do it.
Yeah.
They don't care about anything else.
Yeah. I mean, the confirmation bias thing is definitely real. People, I guess, want the comfort of being told what to do. if I could say one thing, it'd probably be being comfortable with being uncomfortable is probably the best advice, like I think that you can give someone. And when someone tells you something, just feel comfortable to go, maybe, okay. but just not, you don't need to always have a path forward and this is what I need to do next and all that. Sometimes it's just sit in it.
I love that. That summarizes your journey very well. Like you're like 7 years till you felt like the business model was truly validated. Being okay with
a lot of
like,
discomfort, a lot of discomfort.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Did you prepare two truth and one lie?
I did.
Oh, bring it.
One is I was a highly paid fashion model. Number two is I'm a fourth generation Australian. And number three is I have the lap record for Formula 4 at Eastern Creek.
Okay. So I know you're a fourth generation Australian. Now, you did work at a modeling agency. I wonder if they paid you for something. Wait, modeling. Did you do financial modeling?
No, fashion modeling. Well, I am talking about fashion modeling.
Okay, because I talked about Waldy so much in this podcast just because of the commonalities. I'm not like obsessed. I mean, it's fine to be obsessed with him, but he did financial modeling at Macquarie Bank
right.
when I started the fashion business. And he's like, oh, you're looking for a model? I'm really good at modeling. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, sorry. Okay. I've heard somewhere about you making something about racing. So I feel like that's also a thing. I feel like there's something with you in racing. But then you didn't even say that's your hobby, did you? You didn't say that was your hobby. Okay, I'm going to call a friend. Caitlin, what do you think? Yeah, okay. All right, the modeling.
Is the lie?
Yeah.
No, I was actually
damn it.
I have heard that before where the first thing everyone goes is, you obviously mean financial modeling, haha.
Oh,
and
no.
Then the second thing is like, well, obviously it's not real. I was a child model.
Oh.
So I was the Australian ambassador for Reebok, which was Reebok's kids clothing in Reebok? The 80s. Oh, I don't know if it was highly paid, but I think it was a few thousand dollars as a kid
yeah.
to be a model.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And I wish I had the racetrack record for Formula 4, but no, I'm not a very fast driver. I wish I was.
Oh, so I felt like I heard something in my research. I'm like, ooh, this is what I'm gonna get him. But anyway. And sorry, the financial modeling, I've been hearing the dad jokes about financial modeling for years. No, you can blame all that on Caitlin. That's why you tell a friend.
This is a great takedown. It's yeah. like obviously the modeling's not real.
Oh my god.
Thank you so much, Tim. Oh my god, what a great chat. Sorry I've stolen so much of your time. Can you leave us with your advice for entrepreneurs that are listening?
Just try and embrace the discomfort of the ambiguity of starting a business, I think. You're never gonna get told what to do. You gotta be comfortable and courageous to make those calls. So yeah, I would maybe we can coin the term. I would just sit in it.
Yeah, love that. Thank you.
Amazing. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's it from me for now. Thanks for listening. And if you're loving the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review. And if you want more, join the conversation on the podcast Instagram at thelazyceo_podcast. Link to the show notes. Catch you next Tuesday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.